CNN Cable News Network has covered the story and tells us more. A Georgia judge on Wednesday, 20th of March, greenlit an effort by former President Donald Trump and his co-defendants to appeal the decision to allow Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis to continue to prosecute the 2020 election subversion case there. Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee, who ruled last week against the defendants' efforts to disqualify Fannie Willis, has issued a certificate of immediate review, allowing the case to be reviewed by a Georgia appeals court. Judge Scott McAfee wrote, "The issue is of such importance to the case that immediate review should be had. The move doesn't pause the prosecution but allows appeals on the disqualification effort to play out before trial. It is now up to the Georgia Court of Appeals to review the decision not to disqualify Fannie Willis and decide if it wants to take up the case." While Judge Scott McAfee's ruling last week allowed Fannie Willis to stay on the case, it forced the resignation of her top deputy on the case, Nathan Wade. Donald Trump and his co-defendants have argued that a romantic relationship between Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade created a conflict of interest that should disqualify both of them. Steve Sado, the lead defense counsel for Donald Trump in the case, called Wednesday's motion by Judge Scott McAfee highly significant. The defense is optimistic that appellate review will lead to the case being dismissed and the district attorney being disqualified, Steve Sado said in a statement. The American newspaper The Daily Beast has also covered the same story. Georgia judge Scott McAfee is allowing Donald Trump and his election interference co-defendants to appeal an order denying the disqualification of Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis from the case. In a Wednesday, 20th of March certificate of immediate review, Judge McAfee found that the defendant's order asking to review his decision to keep Fannie Willis on the racketeering case is of such importance to the case that immediate review should be had. Last week, Judge Scott McAfee ruled that while Fannie Willis's romantic relationship with then-special prosecutor Nathan Wade had the significant appearance of impropriety, it could be resolved if one of them stepped aside from the case. Nathan Wade resigned just hours later, allowing Fannie Willis to continue leading the team prosecuting Donald Trump and others for allegedly trying to upend the Georgia 2020 election results. The challenge order is not one of final judgment, and the state has informed the court that it has complied with the order's demands, Judge McAfee wrote on Wednesday. He added that the court intends to continue addressing the many other unrelated pending pretrial motions, regardless of whether the petition is granted within 45 days of filing, and even if any subsequent appeal is expedited by the appellate court. The Georgia Court of Appeals could still decline to hear the case. If that happens, defense lawyers could ask the state Supreme Court to hear the appeal. The criminal case against Donald Trump and his co-defendants will continue as this process happens, though no trial date has been set. The defense is optimistic that appellate review will lead to the case being dismissed and the district attorney being disqualified, Steve Sado, who is representing Donald Trump in Georgia, said in a statement to the Daily Beast. In a Monday motion, eight defendants in the election fraud case, considered to be the strongest against Donald Trump, had asked Judge Scott McAfee to allow a review of his ruling on Fannie Willis. In its order, the court found that District Attorney Willis's actions had created an appearance of impropriety and an odor of mendacity that lingers in this case, as well as the continuing possibility that an outsider could reasonably think that District Attorney Fannie Willis is not exercising her independent professional judgment, totally free of any compromising influences, the Monday motion states. It added that a review is both prudent and warranted because there is a lack of guidance from the appellate courts on key issues. In Judge McAfee's ruling, he did not hold back his opinion that the relationship between Nathan Wade and Fannie Willis was improper and demanded some structural changes in the prosecution team. But he also denied the defense's January motion request to remove Fannie Willis because she misused her power and personally benefited from hiring Nathan Wade as a special prosecutor, stating that there is no evidence of an actual conflict of interest brought on by the relationship. This finding is by no means an indication that the court condones this tremendous lapse in judgment or the unprofessional manner of the district attorney's testimony during the evidentiary hearing, the judge wrote in his Friday ruling. Rather, it is the undersigned's opinion that Georgia law does not permit the finding of an actual conflict for simply making bad choices, even repeatedly, and it is the trial court's duty to confine itself to the relevant issues and applicable law properly brought before it. Nathan Wade and Fannie Willis confirmed during an evidentiary hearing last month that they had a relationship from early 2022 until last summer. The two denied any wrongdoing and pushed back on claims that their affair was funded solely by Nathan Wade. USA Today has also covered this story and tells us more. Lawyers for Donald Trump and seven co-defendants filed an emergency appeal on Monday, 18th of March, of a Georgia judge's decision allowing Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis to stay on the sweeping election fraud case against the former president. They contend the ruling doesn't go far enough by just forcing out Special Prosecutor Nathan Wade. Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade admitted to having an affair, but contended that Willis did not improperly benefit from having hired Nathan Wade to oversee the case against Donald Trump and 14 others accused of illegally conspiring to overturn the 2020 election in Georgia. Trump lawyer Stephen Sado said the nine are seeking to disqualify Fannie Willis and the entire district attorney's office, which was the basis of an initial motion filed with Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee on 8th of January. The defendants alleged that Fannie Willis had a clandestine affair with Nathan Wade, the private lawyer she hired to manage the case, and took vacations with him that created a professional conflict of interest. Judge Scott McAfee let Fannie Willis stay on the case as long as she forced out Nathan Wade to preclude any appearance of a conflict of interest going forward.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
The next morning, I continued with my trip to see the Cha Ku Valley. The valley is about 70 kilometers from the city of Resh. It's located in the eastern part of the island. The trail connecting the village to the valley was fantastic, and the landscape stunning. After a rather long walk, I am finally getting close to the Cha Ku Valley. What has been so interesting to me is that the valley is green with rich vegetation. Although Resh is rather a dry island with low rainfall, the valley is spotted with trees and bushes. One reason is that this place is protected from the scorching sun. Another reason is that all the rainwater coming from the surrounding areas gathers in here. In addition, the valley's groundwater is great. These reasons have made this valley so lush with vegetation. Finally, I got to the entrance of the Cha Ku Canyon. It must be very appealing. Look how many eccentric but amazing holes there are at the very beginning point of the canyon. I guess the inside must be much more beautiful. After walking for more than 3 kilometers, I reached the mouth of the valley. Eccentric shapes on the valley's walls began to attract all my attention. But what had made this valley outstanding was something beyond these peculiar shapes. The Cha Ku Canyon is a type of deep, narrow valley with a stone floor. But what distinguishes this from other valleys, like the Collagenia in Tabas and the Kula Khersan in Lorestan, is the existence of these water wells, in addition to geometrical shapes on these walls, like these holes. Some of them are like human or animal heads. This all has distinguished the valley, giving it a very beautiful appearance. It is still full of water. By reserving fresh water, these water wells have been playing a vital role for the villagers of Cha Ku. The locals dug these wells around 400 years ago so as to have access to fresh groundwater here for their own consumption, as well as the consumption of their livestock. Some believe that the name of this valley derives from the name of the man-dug wells in this valley. Others believe the valley owes its name to the existence of a deep natural well created through erosion inside it. What is very clear in relation to Cha Ku is that the locals have learned from nature that they can dig water wells here inside the valley to reserve rainwater inside them. In fact, nature in this valley has appeared as a kind of smart teacher for the locals who are always faced with water shortage. These natural and man-made wells have attracted many birds to this place. The beautiful gazelle of Resh, which needs protection, is seen in the wildlife of the Cha Ku Valley. In fact, the first well here has not been dug by the hands of men, but by nature. Long before, the locals came here to meet their need for water through these wells. Nature, with its own hands, had carved these holes in here. The depths of these wells, for instance, the depth of the well I am standing by right now is about 7 to 8 meters, I guess. In fact, nature has taught the locals to have access to water through digging wells in the valley because after rain, these holes would be filled with water. Little by little, the locals came to the conclusion that they could easily dig wells in this valley to use both rainwater and groundwater. Nature has made these wells through the process of erosion. The more you explore this valley, the more you want to spend time in it. You cannot imagine how beautiful it is here. You keep coming across new forms and shapes. The holes known as pigeon holes, they are the result of wind and water erosion. After rain, water here would reach a height of 8 to 9 meters. Imagine that amount of water moving through this narrow valley. It would carve these pigeon holes here, making the valley wonderful and unique. When it rains here, the valley acts like a natural gutter. Nature has carved this place in the best possible way. This place becomes very attractive in the rain. Of course, it is not pouring with rain, otherwise it would be very dangerous for tourists who might lose their lives if caught here when floodwaters are sweeping across the valley. And the Chaku Crossroads. I finally reached this point. The general form of the Chaku Canyon is like a crossroads. In fact, this valley has been created by two chasms crisscrossing each other. This point is exactly the Chaku Crossroads. It looks like a plus sign from above. It is so narrow that I cannot get through. I have to go on through the upper part. I think that the end of the valley has no way out, just like the other valley I walked in. But this place is so beautiful and the shapes on its walls are so interesting that professional photographers might wish to stay here for weeks to take incredible pictures, on condition that they have enough food and a good place to sleep. And of course, they should not leave garbage here. I have walked through numerous valleys so far, valleys so much deeper and longer than the Chaku Valley. But I dare say that the Chaku Valley is the most beautiful one I have ever walked through so far in terms of form and geology. I'm waiting impatiently for the day when all of us cherish our own rich culture and history and do our best to preserve and enjoy all God has given us. I am really waiting for that day. How narrow this part is. It reminds me of Kula Kherson in Lorestan province. From this point on, it gets very difficult to go through. I mean, it's a mistake to go through the part without technical equipment because the passage is very dangerous with a deep, snaky floor. So, in a way, I have come to the end of this leg of my journey in the Chaku Valley. Walking through the Chaku Valley and admiring its wildlife filled me with good vibes, energy, and peace. But the attraction of the area is not confined to this. Thanks to towering walls, the valley is almost protected from light pollution coming from the city. That means you can have a bright starlit sky in the darkness of Earth. The night sky is one of the most beautiful things you can have in this area. There is yet another attraction on the beaches of Reshm Island. In fact, one of the main attractions in the island, the mangrove or Hara forests of Reshm. The mangrove tree is a shrub or a small tree that grows in coastal saline or brackish water. Representing an important ecological resource, the mangrove forests of Reshm covers an area of approximately 9,000 hectares. They are regarded as the largest sea forests in the whole Persian Gulf. Mangroves are salt-tolerant trees and are adapted to life in harsh coastal conditions. They contain a complex salt filtration system and complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. They're also adapted to the low oxygen conditions of waterlogged mud. It was very interesting for me to sail through different parts of these forests because in addition to their own beauty, they were home to diverse species of birds, amphibians, and fish. It was time to leave the Çakı area and head for another geosite in Reshm Island called the Valley of Stars. The Valley of Stars is located 5 kilometers from the southern beaches of Reshm Island. The soil of the valley is so light that a long, heavy rain can change easily the appearance of the valley itself. This process has been continuing for more than 2 million years. The end of the valley. Inside the Valley of Stars is marked with numerous furrows and passages with no ways out. Each crack I have walked through here has been a dead end. I have to find a passage with a way out. When the wind blows through the valley, it makes eccentric noises. That is mainly due to the valley's special inner structure. In the past, the locals believed that those noises belonged to jinns, but the fact is something else. The fact is that when the wind blows through this valley, it makes different noises as it hits these different shapes and landforms. But what you should be afraid of are human beings rather than jinns. Over the past few days, I've had this amount of garbage, and I have it all in a plastic bag. I think it is a good idea to throw it away right here. But What do you think? Why should I carry it with me all along? If I throw garbage here, when other tourists, who also like to enjoy this pristine place, come here, they will be faced with this ugly scene instead. I'm just one person, and in just a few days, I've had this amount of garbage, and if I leave it here in nature, it'll be like this. And I firmly believe that the nature represents God's own beauty. How can I dare throw this amount of garbage here in nature and deface it? Unfortunately, some tourists leave garbage in nature, which is, in fact, the manifestation of God's beauty and glory. And when a tourist like I, who loves exploring and taking pictures in nature or simply walking in clean, pristine landscapes, comes here, they might face this ugly, disgusting scene instead. I personally cannot even imagine throwing even a small amount of garbage in nature. Do not worry. I just threw the garbage here to show you how we can make nature unattractive with throwing garbage recklessly. But if I collect garbage and clean this place up, other tourists who come here would also enjoy wandering around. I have personally never left garbage in nature. I think the best thing for us to do is to leave no traces in nature and pass nature as pristine as possible to future generations, as our ancestors who were nature-loving people passed it on to us as pristine as possible. If we do not plant trees in nature, the least thing we can do is to avoid throwing away garbage in it. It is the least thing we can do for nature and for our dear country. The floor of the Valley of Stars is covered with fossils and mussel and snail shells. It shows that the whole area and, of course, Reshma Island as a whole was underwater millions of years ago. When it rains heavily, the thin powder-like layer of the ground is washed away and all these shells come to the surface, creating an amazing scene here in the valley. By the way, when I come to this area, I try not to take away these shells because they are beautiful if they remain here. Just imagine if tourists who come here take away some of these shells. Nothing will be left after a while. I've come across many fossils in rock here. Everywhere is full of these mussel and snail shells. Beautiful shapes and natural statue-like formations in the Valley of Stars is very attractive to tourists. But the night sky of this amazing valley can attract many photographers and stargazers, especially at moonlit nights when light, shadow, and eccentric shapes create a wonderful ambience inside the Valley of Stars. I was coming to the end of my trip. I went to the amazing island of Resh to watch its nature, wildlife, geosites, and pristine beaches, as well as its local architecture and culture. The island is unique in terms of its diverse tourist attractions and its high potential for ecotourism. I left this beautiful island in the Persian Gulf, leaving the least possible traces of myself behind.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرض.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. This is To My Brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. It's great to have all of you here, and today we want to talk about a character who not only influenced Muslims across the world, but influenced many non-Muslims as well. This great personality is the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace and blessings upon him. Imam Ali alayhi salam was brought up under the care of the Holy Prophet Muhammad when he was just a small child. And so in this manner, the foundation of the moral and spiritual education of this magnificently intelligent child was based by the Prophet of Islam himself, the greatest educator of all mankind. Imam Ali's mental faculties were to an extent that he believed in the Holy Prophet and his mission at the tender age of 8. Therefore, Imam Ali, contrary to the other companions of the Holy Prophet, had never worshipped idols and never partook in the unreasonable demands, the oppressive actions, or the unjust acts of the Arab chieftains. Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. So, dear friends, again, the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, a beautiful persona indeed, this persona which radiates with the light of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, this beautiful manifestation of the teachings of the Holy Quran and the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. And of course, we are also in the holy month of Ramadan, the month in which the divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali alayhi salam, really encouraged the believers to take this month seriously. We find when we're talking about the persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is that His Eminence, very rarely do we find that he went and he complained or whined about the problems and difficulties that he was facing in His Eminence's life. Now, of course, we find that the difficulties that Imam Ali alayhi salam faced, they were very severe difficulties and severe trials on many various different levels, and something that perhaps we should talk about in our programs later on, if Allah wills. But there's this aspect that you never saw him whine or complain to somebody else about these trials and difficulties. And yes, there are instances, for example, we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam would go to the wells in the depth of the night, and he would weep in these wells because he did not have anybody to be able to talk about these certain aspects that needed to come out, but there was no companion. And of course, this is an incident that occurred after the martyrdom of Lady Fatimatu Zahra, peace and blessings upon her, because when she was alive, she was a companion whom Imam Ali alayhi salam could speak with and share his sorrows. But the point here, which I'm getting to, is that Imam Ali alayhi salam, you know, you don't find him, lamenting about his problems all the time out loud. And this is a part of perhaps the traditions that speak about how Imam Ali says that sorrow lies within the heart of a believer, but not necessarily not on his face, right? So this idea that what we just talked about is that one should not always be complaining and whining out loud and lamenting about the sorrows and griefs. Everybody, dear friends, is facing some sort of sorrow or grief or some kind of sadness or trial or difficulty or tribulation or calamity or tragedy. Everybody is facing these things, right? And if everybody started to lament and cry and whine and complain about all these things that are happening to each one of us, the world would be an incredibly depressing and, you know, sad place to live in, if you can imagine, for a little while. But Islam teaches us to be cheerful, to try to be patient, be steadfast, to keep that aspect of grief within our hearts. Now, just before we end, because we've probably run out of time, unfortunately, is that this does not mean that we don't talk to somebody. We should be able to have, you know, first and foremost, it is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and then the infallible and immaculate household, well, the Messenger of Allah and his Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessings upon them all. But apart from them, you know, if need be, we need to have some kind of a intimate friend, an individual that we trust, that we rely on, upon whom, you know, every now and then when it's absolutely necessary, we talk about our grief and we talk about the things that are bothering us so that we are alleviated somewhat from this pain. But to be constantly lamenting and whining, that is something that is not appropriate. A very comprehensive lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Aminullah along with its English translations. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Allahumma fastajib du'ayi واقبل ثناي واجمع بيني وبين أوليائي بحق محمد.
O Allah, give favorable answer to my prayer. Acknowledge the praise I sign in worship. Let there be peace and harmony between me and my friends for the sake of Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Al-Hassan and Al-Hussein. Verily, thou art my benefactor who provides with bounties, the aim of my desires, the ultimate destination of my hopes in my future life and during this short life. Thou art my God, my Master and my Lord. Welcome my friends, keep our enemies away from us. To save us from the evil mischief, divert their attention. Let the true world come out in the open, supreme and dominant. Refute and condemn the fully, rendered contemptible. Verily, thou art able to do all things.
Bye.
And now we invite you to listen to Fayyaz Ja'far.
In terms of understanding then, what exactly did the Imam alayhi salatu wasalam say toward Malik al-Ashtar in terms of taking over the importance of this position as the governor of Egypt? We have to understand that the Imam and all of the Imams of Ahlul Bayt alayhim wasalam, they set down very unique guidelines, first of all, in regards toward people who took positions of leadership. You go toward Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam, he has what is known as the rights of the leader. When you go toward a letter by Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Rida alayhi salam, he writes a letter toward Harun al-Rashid in which he advises him about what it means toward being a leader. When you go toward the advices of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam on the day of Ashura that he uttered toward the army of Umar ibn Sa'd, he explained toward them the role and the responsibilities of taking positions of leadership. But again, nothing is perhaps more eloquent than these words of the commander of the faithful toward Malik al-Ashtar. And he tries to advise his companion, and in reality we can take lessons from every single one of his advices in terms of how he should be amongst those who win the hearts of the people. What makes the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, what made Ahlul Bayt alayhi wa salatu wa salam so lovable? What made these individuals so polarizing that everyone looked toward them, wanted to spend time with them, is because they were human beings. They didn't demonstrate themselves with this garb of superiority when they walked with people. They were the Imams of Ahlul Bayt, my friends. They were the owners of the universe. Yet they still would hang out, they would eat, they would talk, they would make jokes. When people would come from Kufa toward visiting Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, the Imam would make jokes, he would converse, he would be sarcastic with them. The first conversations that he would have with them is, you know, how's it going? What type of work do you do? When the guy would say, I'm a fruit vendor, he would tell them, and what's the cost of peaches and what's the cost of oranges? He would make small talk with people. He was someone who opened up his heart. The Imams of Ahlul Bayt opened up their heart in order to create an access point, an entry point for everyone around them to engage with. And when we go towards seeing the instruction of Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam toward Malik al-Ashtar, amongst the main themes and advices that he gives them in terms of being a leader is telling him, oh Malik, know that you have a responsibility where people have to be receptive to you. And if people love you, they're going to follow whatever you have to say. But if people don't love you, well, they're going to write a lot of mean emails about you. Another piece of advice given by Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam toward Malik al-Ashtar, he says, oh Malik, in the same way that you look at leaders, people will look at you. What do you mean, oh Amir al-Mu'mineen? In the same way that you scrutinize leaders, you scrutinize people who take positions on the member, giving talks, reciting poetry, taking positions of community leadership, whatever it might be, know that people will scrutinize you. And the same way that you speak about leaders, people are going to speak about you. So just get ready for all of the bad things that you're about to hear from people. But at the same time, know that you don't want anyone to use that sort of language and use that sort of rhetoric, so be two steps ahead. In reality, Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salatu wasalam demonstrates such concern for Malik al-Ashtar. Why? Because again, if we take a look at it from the context of Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wasalam, who was more scrutinized than Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi? Every walk, every word, every step of the Imam alayhi salatu wasalam, he had Muawiyah from one side, he had these guys from the other side, he had a third group from the other side, watching his every step. And he's trying to tell Malik al-Ashtar, oh Malik, know that in the same way that you look at people or that you looked at people, people are going to look at you. So when you assume the position of responsibility, then be careful the way that you speak, and be careful the way that you dress, and be careful the way that you converse with people. And every single movement of yours, everyone is going to observe. Just because of the throne or the chair that you're sitting on, just because of the garb that you're wearing, and every single misstep that you make might potentially be a problem for you. And in reality, we see that in reality, every single day, we do the same exact thing. We as people within our own communities, but in reality, that's exactly what people, in terms of their essential nature, do.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Joe Biden sears his name in history by becoming the first sitting American president to be sued for complicity in genocide over the United States abetment in the Israeli regime's ongoing genocidal war in Gaza. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The New Yorker magazine has covered this story and tells us more. As it continues to devour Palestinian lives in the Gaza Strip, U.S. President Joe Biden has urged the Israeli war machine to be given more time. Biden said in an interview, "I think they have to give this just a little bit of time." The comments came as the Palestinian death toll from an October 7th to present-day genocidal war by the Israeli regime crossed 30,500 mark. The Israeli regime launched its devastating war following the Al-Aqsa Storm Operation, a surprise operation by Gaza's resistance groups, including Hamas, against the occupied Palestinian territories that was staged in response to intensification of Tel Aviv's decades-long campaign of occupation and aggression against Palestinians. Apparently trying to justify Tel Aviv's resolve to keep up the military onslaught, Joe Biden said the pressure on the Israeli leadership to move with every ounce of capacity against Hamas is real. Israel has vowed not to stop the aggression until the realization of its declared goals, including destruction of Hamas, which many dismiss as unattainable. Meanwhile, the U.S. president alleged, "I think you're going to see... I'm praying you're going to see a significant downturn in the use of force." On 26th of January this year, the International Court of Justice, the United Nations' top court, ordered the Israeli regime to take all measures within its power to prevent genocide in Gaza. However, the Israeli regime has significantly ramped up its strikes across the coastal sliver ever since. It is also about to go ahead with a ground offensive against the southern Gaza city of Rafah, which has come to host more than 1.5 million, of the territory's 2.4 million strong population who have fled the ravages of the war. Joe Biden claimed, "I don't want to see any Palestinians killed. I think that it's contrary to what we believe as Americans." As part of its consistent political patronage of the Israeli regime, the United States, which is Tel Aviv's main benefactor, has so far vetoed three United Nations Security Council resolutions that have called for implementation of an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. The Israeli aggression also enjoys unreserved military and intelligence support on the part of Washington. Last month, more than 100,000 people voted uncommitted in Michigan's Democratic primary in an attempt to push Joe Biden on the issue. The group Listen to Michigan, which spearheaded the movement in less than a month with very little financial resources, tweeted, "Our movement emerged victorious tonight and massively surpassed our expectations." Tens of thousands of Michigan Democrats, many of whom who voted for Biden in 2020, are uncommitted to his re-election due to the war in Gaza, adding, "President Biden has funded the bombs falling on the family members of people who live right here in Michigan. People who voted for him, who now feel completely betrayed. President Biden, listen to Michigan. Count us out, Joe." Qatar's Al Jazeera television network has also covered the same story and tells us more. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says history will not erase the Biden administration's disgraceful complicity in the Israeli regime's ongoing genocidal war against the Gaza Strip. Hamas's political bureau chief Ismail Haniyeh made the remark recently following a meeting with Qatar's Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani. Ismail Haniyeh said the United States was providing a cover for the Israeli regime's war of starvation against Gaza. He was apparently referring to American officials lamenting the situation in Gaza at the same time that Washington retained its unbridled support for the war. Ismail Haniyeh said the American cover for the crime of starvation that the occupation uses as a weapon to achieve political goals is a disgrace to humanity that history will not erase, even if the American administration hides behind misleading statements about the humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip. The Hamas leader added, "It will not absolve the United States of its responsibility and participation in war crimes committed against defenseless civilians in Gaza." Ismail Haniyeh also denounced what he called the Israeli regime's refusal to provide decisive responses to mediators' efforts to broker a ceasefire. He said Hamas responded to the efforts of the mediator brothers, agreed to the course of negotiations on stopping the aggression, and showed great seriousness and flexibility. But it believes that the Israeli regime is stalling, which the movement Hamas will not accept in any way. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story and tells us more. Joe Biden sears his name in history by becoming the first sitting American president to be sued for complicity in genocide over the United States' abetment in the Israeli regime's ongoing genocidal war in Gaza. The first hearing in the case was being held at the federal courthouse in Oakland, California recently. Human rights bodies and Palestinian U.S. citizens are plaintiffs in the lawsuit, which was lodged by the Center for Constitutional Rights, a New York-based legal advocacy organization, in mid-February. The Center for Constitutional Rights filed the lawsuit on behalf of Dr. Omar al-Najjar, a physician at Nasser Medical Complex in the city of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza Strip, as well as Palestinian human rights groups, Defense for Children International, Palestine and Al-Haq. The lawsuit also names U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and the Secretary of State Antony Blinken. The United States has been providing the Israeli regime with all-out military and political support. It has armed the regime with more than 10,000 tons of military hardware and blocked ratification of all United Nations Security Council resolutions that have called for cessation of Israeli aggression in Gaza. The lawsuit states, if the legal responsibility to prevent an unfolding genocide is to mean anything, indeed, if the rule of law is to signify anything, courts must have a role and responsibility to enforce these foundational international law principles, adding, the lives of so many more people are at stake. Sadaf Doust, a Birth Justice Fellow with the Center for Constitutional Rights, told The Independent, I'm certainly not aware of another sitting US president who has had charges of complicity in genocide brought against him in a federal court of law, or against his senior cabinet members, a testament in and of itself to the gravity of the US's significant role in this genocide, the crime of crimes. Sadaf Doust noted, a court hearing in the case would force the Biden administration to confront what it has gone to great lengths to deny or even recognize, and through a public, permanent record.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Salman Qasimi, an Islamic school teacher, says it's an unprecedented move in India to ban madrasas instantly, calling it a blow to marginalized Muslim families across India's most populous state of Uttar Pradesh. He says lives of thousands of families are directly dependent on such institutions, while the government of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi accuses them of receiving illegal funding. Scholars argue such institutions are building blocks of Islamic teachings across the country, which regular schools can't do.
This judgment is unfortunate. We respect the court decision, but we oppose it. Our constitution allows us to have such schools to teach Islamic values to future generations. If this is against secularism, why it was made in the first place? Every citizen can read, write, promote or propagate their religion. That's what our constitution says. Madrasa's instant closure is a blow to livelihood of thousands of families.
In January, the government of Uttar Pradesh state halted a funding program for madrasas, leaving more than 20,000 teachers unemployed. Scholars say Friday's verdict applies to all Islamic schools in the state that are privately and government funded. In recent months, India's northeastern state of Assam converted hundreds of madrasas into conventional schools.
All the laws and all the things which are BJP is enacting or BJP is targeting the Muslim community, definitely they think that the if they want to rule the country, so they can rule the country when they can demonize Muslim community, they can suppress Muslim community, they can make them vetless at the time of election. So all these efforts are taking place because of the RSS background, RSS agenda of the present ruling party.
In recent months, Modi's